Good morning. This is Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at WSOU.net. Back with us this week is Ken Doctor, the author of Newsonomics, 12 Trends That Will Shape the News That We Get. Ken, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I tell you, we really had a very spirited discussion about the newspaper industry last week, and what I like to do this week is to talk about the new mediums that are the new devices that we're reading this news on. So what is all the hype about the iPad, Ken? Can you help us understand how the iPad is different from the Kindle or it's different from the Nook?
Sure. I think, you know, I mean, I live out here. I live out in San Jose, so I'm close to the waves emanating out from Cupertino and Apple's headquarters, but sometimes we can be a little off because of that. But I've thought since I've seen it that it will be a revolutionary device. Now I think the difference is that it combines what people have loved about the iPhone. And there are now, I think, 30 million of those little things that have sold, even though we're all stuck on the AT&T network.
Which is horrible, by the way.
Which does not work in the Bay Area and New York, two places I tend to be a lot. So even though they have some problems, it's not really much of a phone. It's an incredible next-generation computer. And at the same time, it's been out here, what, about 2.5, 3 years, something like that? At the same time, you know, those of us that have normal-sized fingers say, oh, my God, you know, it's just, you know, it's great. I can read the news anywhere. I can do this. I can do games. I can look up, you know, movies when I'm out and that kind of stuff. But it's not a great reading experience. So the whole idea of the iPad, I think, was to grab the wonder of the iPhone and the idea of having a real portable computer, but to have it be something that fit the human hand and had a screen big enough where you could read more than, you know, 25 words at a time. And so, of course, they played with how big, how small, how heavy, all those kinds of questions. And this is clearly still a first-generation product. You know, we'll look back even in 5 years, and I think, you know, we'll be impressed, but the tablets that we're carrying around, and I think many of us will be carrying around tablets in 3 to 5 years, will be a little different, and they'll be better. I think the main difference is that it's a consuming device and not a producing device. And we think about laptops, and some people will say, a lot of techies have said online, and when you talk to people, they'll say, well, it's just a laptop. You know, I don't get it. It's a laptop. But it's not quite as versatile as a laptop, and where's the keyboard, right?
Right, right.
But if you are mainly consuming content, whether it's news or it's games or it's you know, reading the web, whatever it is, you don't need a keyboard, especially, and that's the number two part of it. You know, we use our hands. I like the fact that 50,000 years ago, they think, is when humans learned how to talk. Now that's not very long ago. What did we do before that? We gestured, and some people still gesture a lot, right?
That's right.
So, you know, we're used to using our hands, some more than others, right? I'm not sure if the advanced people use their hands more or the least advanced. I'm not sure.
I don't know. The freeways in California there, you see a lot of hand gestures.
A lot of hand gestures, right? So we know how to do that. I've got a two-year-old granddaughter who, when she was 15 months old, learned how to advance the music on her father's it was an iTouch, but the idea of how do you move stuff along. So what they did is they understand how humans like to operate things. So I think the combination is a consumer device. People like to use their hands much more than a keyboard, where we've kind of been stuck behind a keyboard, which is an unnatural position. And then, yeah, probably thirdly, color. Yeah, I mean, it's a color world. It's not a black and white world. And a device, you know, you think back to the first computers, which were black and white.
Black and white.
And I remember we got an Apple II GS. Oh, my God, it had graphics, it had sound, it had color. People want color, they want freedom, And it represents that possibility and that allure. Now, for news companies, it's fascinating because it's a new device. And so, as a new device, they're saying, how do we use this? And I'm afraid too many of them are doing what they did with other new technologies, and what they're doing is they're porting over basically the same news content, as opposed to what you can actually do with this platform. And if you look at, I don't know how many of your listeners have looked at the Sports Illustrated demo. They did a demo of a Sports Illustrated tablet product, and this came out first or second week in January. It's now been viewed almost a million times, that one demo, three-minute demo video on YouTube.
Mm.
And when you look at that, you see, this could be the new news world where I not just can read the news of the day, I can go back and forth in time, I can go in-depth to certain stories, I look at photo montages, I can look at video of yesterday's game, I can stop it where I want to stop it and start it where I want to start it. And you kind of look at it and you say, of course, you should be able to do this because all of that's available technology. So in terms of a product and what it can do for the news business, I'm very high on what it can do as a product. And then it offers very similar advertising advances of what you can do to sell products and sell services. So I think it's going to be a very significant change on the landscape for news companies, both because of product and advertising.
Now, one of the criticisms that I've heard about the iPad is that if you're on a train or a bus and there's a lot of sunlight, the screen is difficult to read.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that from some people, too. And I think, you know, that is one of many issues that will be worked out. It's been true, I think, of the iPhone as well. But still, you know, if you add up the pluses and the minuses, many people are willing to, you know, say, okay, I'll adjust to that at this point. Yeah, there are a number of negatives to it. But there's also going to be a whole slew of tablets coming from other companies, and they're going to get cheaper. It's still fairly expensive, you know. It's just been out, 2 months, 3 months now.
Right.
It's going to get a lot cheaper. I think they'll deal with the screen issues that are there, and as it comes down in price point, and if it's available on other carriers, I think it's something that many people will use. Even the early sales, some of the early sales surpassed iPhone, which is fairly amazing.
You know, in your opinion, what do you think is the number one item that's going to be consumed on the iPad? Will it be movies versus reading books?
It would depend how you count it. You know, mm-hmm. I think it will be current information. If you still look at it, people like currency. People still take in. And this is fascinating. They take in an hour of news a day, which is the same as we did about 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We just take it in differently. You know, right. We have a lot of digital ways of doing it. And so I think if you look at that, an hour a day, that's still a pretty prime use. Sometimes people will watch movies, and it's a two-hour experience, and sometimes they use it for mapping and finding a restaurant where they are and all the location-aware potentials of it. But I think current use is going to still be a major driver of it, just as it is of the web today.
And, you know, let's talk a little bit futuristic here, digital paper. I've heard about digital paper for a number of years, but it has not come to fruition yet. Have you seen any demonstrations of potential digital paper products that might come out to displace the iPad?
Well, it's interesting. There's a bunch of companies working on it. You know, a lot of the digital paper ideas came out of MIT. And, you know, on the one hand, it is in the lab. What do you think people want? And we all grew up with paper. We know the feel of paper. Older people especially like the feel of paper. Younger people, no, they're fine reading digitally, and they don't really feel the need to have paper in their hands. So a lot of the early paper experimentation was to say, people like paper, let's make these pixels more paper-like. Well, as each generation is growing up, as digital first generations, I think in some sense that's less important. So, there have been both attempts to make digital products that you could actually roll, so that it wouldn't be a fixed hard plastic product, but could roll more like paper. And in fact, a couple of the companies that were working on that decided to go the other way to a fixed product, because they found that consumers knew how to handle that better and liked the solidity of it better than rolled paper, even though you could essentially roll up the electronic version. So part of it's technology, and part of it's what people will adapt to and what people will like. So I think, the lightness of it is probably, how heavy it is or how light it is important. The factor you brought up of, can I read the screen in different kinds of light environments, those kinds of things, I think are going to be more important than actually making it feel like paper.
When you were coming back from the UK last week, you participated in a Outsell, I believe it's Brain Gain, forum on digital publishing. On the airplane, what was the prominent device that you saw that people were utilizing?
I saw both. I saw a few iPads. I saw a few Kindles. And I saw most of the people sleeping. there weren't... It was a flight. Yeah, there were, I'd say, I don't know whether 200 people on that flight. There were probably four or five iPads, four or five Kindles, a bunch of people using laptops and working and making endless PowerPoint slides.
Right.
And all. It was funny. I got on a flight when I think last time I saw you, we were in New York for that SII conference.
That's correct.
And I got on the plane in San Jose for New York, and I looked over. I had an aisle seat, and I looked over at the two people to the right of me, and they were both reading on Kindles, like black and white Kindle screens, and there I was holding the Mercury News in print. And I thought that was pretty ironic.
Something about having a little bit of that ink on your fingertips, right?
It's very portable. It was a great invention.
That's right. That's right. You had mentioned that on your flight back over that folks were looking at the volcanic ash.
Yeah.
Now, on your plane, did you have Wi-Fi access?
No, it's funny. I've had that. I've been doing a lot of flying over the last month, and there's this new GoGo service that American has and Delta, and I'm not sure. It's on several of the carriers, but not all of them. So I'd signed up for a month. I figured $34, 30 days, this is a pretty good deal. And it was. I actually went down to Latin America and I used it there.
Mm-hmm.
But American didn't have it across the Atlantic.
Oh. Oh.
And, it seems to be, I don't know whether they're, refitting planes and they haven't done them all or what they're doing, but it would seem like on a transatlantic flight it would be a perfect use for it, but it wasn't in place yet.
Absolutely, and then it allows you to use it, utilize the network, no matter where you are in the world.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to send my pictures of the ash cloud.
Right,
right. Take from the window. I wanted to send them right when we were over the ash cloud. I thought that would be pretty cool.
I'm just thinking about when different serious incidents are occurring on these planes, and now with this technology, we're going to have folks who are going to be reporting right from their seat.
That's right.
And given us, as John Blossom, who's the author of Content Nation, he talks about everybody's a publisher.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's the ultimate in crowdsourcing if you're on a plane that's having problems.
And explain to us, if you can, of course you can, you wrote the book, Local and Remap and Reload.
Yeah. Well, and local, I think we talked about last week, there's this Digital Dozen, which are national and global companies.
Yes.
And they're going after these 900 million English-speaking people. So if they create a story or a post or a video, they have a wide range of potential customers. And every time they get views on that, they can monetize that video or story. That's a huge economy of scale. Unfortunately, the opposite is now true of local media. So if you were a metro newspaper, if you were the Mercury News, or you were the Chicago Tribune, or the Dallas Morning News, or the Newark paper, you would, in 10, 15 years ago, you'd be bringing your readers the whole world. You would bring them the local news, but you'd also bring them the top of the national news, international, sports, business, travel, even, you know, movies, whatever. That was the window into the world for your readers. Now, because the Digital Dozen are busy providing content from around the world, and there are top-flight entertainment sites, business sites, travel sites, you name it, all of which provide really good tools as well as content, local is left with really reporting local news. So I talked about it in terms of rebooting and reloading, because really they've had to change their mindset from being a nationally oriented paper to some degree, usually in the A section, and business oriented another, to really focusing on local news. And that means their staffs, which are diminished greatly, about 20% fewer journalists working in 25% fewer journalists working in U.S. newsrooms now compared to 5-6 years ago. And those that are left are focused on that local news report. That means that they have to do that. They have to do it well. But it also means that their readers are only looking to them for the news and information about a smaller part of their world. They're not looking to them for that report about the whole world, but only a smaller part of it. And consequently, the readers are spending less time with local news media because they're spending more time with national news media and sites like MarketWatch or Metacritic or, you know, ESPN. It's really diminished. They're really the diminished newspapers, especially the metros, and diminished operations, and they're really trying to find a future.
Yeah. You know, during the last election, CNN hired a number of journalists to cover the local news in regards to the political election. Do you happen to know if those journalists were still employed, or was that just a short-term gig that they got for the election?
I don't know specifically on those. I know they have started some other that really tests some local operations, which went beyond elections in a few cities. And these are small bureaus to try to be more local with their own staff. But they have tested out. I mean, it's fascinating for anybody that comes out of the print business, because CNN is trying to learn how to be a non-TV company. With CNN on TV is plainly flagging, right? It's the fourth network in terms of ratings. But CNN.com is one of the major, most successful news sites on the web. What they're really trying to do is they're figuring out, in a sense, how to do text. They're finding out how to do stories as opposed to just doing stand-ups in front of cameras. What their legacy is. So what they're doing is both trying to do text, and they were doing a number of experiments with local to see does it make economic sense to do local. ESPN's been doing the same thing. You know, it's been putting out sites in Chicago and other big cities.
Is that the iVideo that they have?
I think it's just ESPN local. I think it's like ESPN Chicago is how they brand it.
Okay. And what do you
CNN think? is doing their iReport.
Right, the iReport, yes.
Which is a huge user-generated operation, which is that other, you know, big trend of how do you get readers to create a lot of content for you that you can put under your brand. And you can get it essentially for free. So they've done that, and they're pretty much leaders in that. But I think they're struggling with local, and they're struggling with how to get how to get local at a low enough cost point, which is a big question for a lot of these companies.
Right. And what do you think of Patch.com?
It's interesting. You know, it's AOL. It's Tim Armstrong, and it's the latest attempt to do hyper-local journalism, meaning journalism in a small community of somewhere between 30 and 50,000 people, usually, but to do it in a templated way. So they have, if you go to Patch, they started in New Jersey and Connecticut, a few sites there. They look very similar because they're all on the same platform, the same design. And then they use a few local people who try to get a lot of other local people to write for free. In the past, it's been really hard to scale. There have been other operations like Backfence that have tried that. Clearly, we all want to know something about our neighborhoods, but how much time we want to put into it is a question, how much time we're willing to spend on it. And also, there's the question of whether you can link up enough local advertising to pay for those local sections. Now, that's really an advertising company, and the guy who heads it came from Google Advertising, so maybe they'll figure that out. But the whole idea there is hyper-local across the United States with, you know, hundreds of sites. And I think in that case, readers, again, benefit because there is a lot of local coverage that they are spawning that really wasn't done very well by the Metro papers. So it's a plus in coverage. Whether it works as a business, I don't know.
Right, right, right. So, you know, in your fourth trend, you talk about the old news world is gone, get over it. And I guess that's like the traditional manufacturing in the United States. It's moved on. It's moved overseas.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's happening in the journalism schools? How are they addressing this issue?
Well, the best schools are really have really blown up their old curriculum. And they are preparing this new generation of journalists to be different kinds of storytellers. And I think I've been able to talk to probably five or six journalism schools. And I think they're following similar paths. And they're saying, okay, we don't know what the world's going to look like. We don't know how many jobs there's going to be for new journalists. Given all the cutbacks in traditional journalism. But clearly, people are going to want journalism, and there are a lot of new startup companies that want to hire people, not pay them a lot, but want to hire people. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to equip their news editorial people with broader storytelling skills. So it used to be you would follow a path where you might be in newspaper journalism or magazine journalism or broadcast journalism. Now they're essentially saying to all of them, you've got to learn how to do audio, you've got to learn how to do video, you've got to learn how to write, you've got to learn how to edit. So they're getting a much broader range of skills. I don't think that they've made as much advances on the advertising side. And advertising and PR are two other big parts of journalism schools and communication schools. And those fields are changing just as rapidly. On the news editorial side, they are better preparing them with skills of storytelling. As I've talked to them, I've said, you know, the other skill I think is really important is you teach them essentially how to run their own small business. That if it's going to be a gig economy, there's a lot more chance they're going to be an independent contractor. That they're not going to work as an employee for one company, but they're going to have to work for three or four companies, just like journalists had to do 60, 70 years ago. And that way, people need to understand how basically to run their own work lives and take responsibility for it. And that's a whole other set of skills and tools.
Mm-hmm. Now, with all of the journalists who were laid off and all of the changes, and we have people who are blogging, we have people who are not traditional journalists in a sense, what about the quality of the content that we're reading? Do you think that has remained on par or has it suffered?
I think it's definitely suffered. I think it's suffered for several reasons. One of them is the one you note, that you look at, not only have we lost 20-25% of the daily journalists in a very short period of time, but disproportionately, these are people who are the most experienced people in the newsrooms. And they could be irascible and hard to deal with. I can tell you that as having been a managing editor. But they knew their communities. You know, they'd been in those communities for 20, 25 years oftentimes, at places like City Hall and school districts and local big companies. They knew how to separate out when people were blowing smoke from when they were telling the truth, because they had the background, they had the experience, and they knew who to talk to. We've lost, you know, tens of thousands of years of experience there. And as younger people come on, the traditional route in newsrooms is really, I think you alluded to when you talked about manufacturing, it's really an old industrial model. And part of that industrial model was apprenticeship. And it was a loose apprenticeship. It's not like a, you know, it's not like a Dickensian apprenticeship, but it was, you know, the younger people came on, and the older people taught them the ropes. They taught them, you know, whether it was a certain beat or who to talk to or what mistakes not to make. And that's gone from a lot of newsrooms. So if you look at papers, not only are they thinner today, you know, they're physically thinner, but a lot of the stories, and I can unfortunately attest to that with the Mercury News here in San Jose where I live, which used to be a reliably top 10 newspaper in quality. It's a lot thinner, but a lot of stories are, you know, what we call one or two source stories. You know, talk to a couple people, but you don't get the sense that they have talked to enough sources that they know what's going on, and they're telling you what's going on with any particular story. And it's hard, I think, for readers to put their finger on it. They know there's less there. They'll know if people are involved in communities, you hear, I see a reporter a lot less than I used to. So you hear all these kind of anecdotal things, but the basic foundation of this is we don't know what we don't know, because there's a lot less journalism being done, and much of the journalism that's being done is being done at a lesser standard. And so there's a lot of things we don't know in our communities that we would have known 5 years ago.
Ken, we have a couple minutes left, and I'd like to ask you a question in regards to the DNA of the new leadership that we need in digital publishing. What is the DNA of that new digital newsprint leader?
Well, I think that it is a wide understanding that in this digital world, it's a world that is really one of concentric circles. So that in the past, these news companies were essentially vertical industrial companies. The old Andrew Carnegie model, where, you know, you owned everything. Newspaper companies owned distribution, advertising, printing, everything. Now they are going to have a smaller core of news producers and really advertising sellers, a lot smaller staff, but then the potential through having that staff, and especially the news staff, work with people in the community who are themselves doing blogs and doing really good community sites. Seattle Times is doing this, Miami Herald is doing this, so they're able to leverage a lot more community coverage within a certain standard, which they can put under their brand, through that kind of second concentric circle. You can bring in people, some of them are journalists, some people are not journalists, but you can bring in more content from your site. You're just doing it in a different way. And then, of course, maybe the third circle is, how do you work with readers who, you know, through in the Facebook era, really want to contribute? A lot of this is just conversation, but at the high end, there's a lot of sharing and learning that you can do within communities, so that the DNA is really learning how to reach out, and that you're not as an insular newspaper publisher or editor as many people have been in the industry, but you are really someone who reaches out for both community relationships, business partnerships, and you look at how to expand, rather than contract.
Wow. Ken, wow, that was very, very insightful in regards to what the new leadership needs to have in regards to good characteristics. Well, Ken, this has been an exciting last 2 weeks for me. I want to thank you for all of your time, for coming on the program.
You are quite welcome. It was good to talk with you.
Here we are. This is Darrell Gunter with Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. We're here with Ken Doctor, who is the author of Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get. He is also the Vice President Analyst with Outsell, Inc. This is Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership. And remember, leadership begins with you. Have a great week.